Welcome to this talk from the Canando Zen Meditation Center. Located in Mountain View, California, Canando's meditation practice is open to the public. For more information or to get in touch with us, you can visit our website at canando.org. That's K-A-N-N-O-N-D-O.org.
Hey, good evening. I guess I don't have an actual title for this talk because what Les asked me to do was talk about how it was that I came to practice and what it means to me. In other words, a way-seeking mind talk. My journey to Zen is a little unusual in the sense that I started getting interested in Zen back in about 1970. And for almost 35 years, all I did was read about Zen in books, but I never actually sat Zazen until about 2002, about 20 years ago. So I guess since in 1970, the Beatles released a song called The Long and Winding Road, I guess I'm inclined to steal that title for my talk as well. What in the world was going on that caused me to wait for 30 years between reading it? I'm not saying I just had heard about Zen. I mean, I started reading a lot about Zen and collecting Zen books and everything. So what was going on? So let me go back to my original background. As a kid, I was raised by a couple of parents who were liberal democratic Protestants. They bounced around between the Congregational Church, the Methodist Church, and the Presbyterian Church, basically depending on which minister was giving the most intellectualized, brainiest sermons. So that was sort of my introduction. And those of you who know me well can imagine that I inherited a certain amount of that attitude from my parents. But at about 14, I went to a classmate's bar mitzvah. And boy, those people took their religion seriously. And that kind of resonated with the sort of early teenage existential angst I was starting to feel. And finally, at 15, about a year later, I let a friend talk me into a deep dive into Christianity. I joined Youth for Christ. I mean, this is about as fundamentalist, you know, as you can get. And needless to say, my polite, liberal, democratic Protestant parents were horrified. I can just imagine the conversations that went on between them late at night when I was asleep and they were talking about this. So, but I'm sure that my father had great confidence in the fact that this was a phase I was passing through. And sure enough, about a year later, I dropped out of the whole thing and actually sort of, you know, flew out of the whole thing at fairly high speed. I came away with a very deep skepticism about religion in general and Christianity in particular. So now, fast forward a few years, and I'm a student at Berkeley. And just sort of marinating in the whole atmosphere in Berkeley at the time. And amidst all the sex and drugs and rock and roll, there really was an incoherent but very sincere spiritual hunger, not just for me, but for a lot of people in Berkeley society at the time. And in fact, right around then, I joined a yoga group. So this yoga group was Hatha, which is the postures, plus meditation. But first off, there was a fairly ornate belief system that you had to adopt. And you can imagine that I was not going into it with that as a major attraction for me, since I had been shooting out of Youth for Christ, which had about the most elaborate belief system you can imagine. And, you know, this was all about Kundalini and chakras and all this stuff, and explained why it was we were doing all this meditation and Hatha yoga. Hatha, some of you may know, is basically traditionally seen as a preparation for meditation. And then meditation is all about your Kundalini and your chakras and so forth. So the belief came first, and then came the Hatha and the meditation. And the beliefs got thicker and thicker, and I finally couldn't stand it, and I dropped out again. But around that same time, I began reading books on Zen. I started with Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. Actually went to an author talk by the author of Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. And there was this wonderful little Shambhala bookstore right in the middle of the whole Telegraph Avenue hippie student activist scene. And I bought and read more and more Zen books. I mean, for me, Zen became sort of fascinating intellectual puzzle to read and think about. I had several interests sort of like that. I got very interested in evolutionary biology and astrophysics, and Zen became sort of one more fascinating intellectual puzzle. About the same time, I also got interested in mathematical logic, partly as my studies in my graduate school studies at Berkeley. And in particular, one thing in that kind of struck me. Early in the 20th century, the big goal of mathematics, or a big goal of mathematics, was to prove that mathematics is both consistent and complete. It's sort of like when you swear in court that you're going to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. It's the whole truth, meaning it's complete, and nothing but the truth, meaning that it's consistent. And somewhat surprisingly, there started to be famous results by mathematicians like Kurt Gödel showing that consistent logical systems are always incomplete. That is, there are always truths in that logical system that you cannot derive logically. And that was actually a sort of thunderbolt in the mathematical community about 100 years ago. And the nugget of the arguments for that always seemed to involve self-referential paradoxes. If you try to basically trick the logical system into effectively understanding itself, it breaks down. So that idea just got sort of tucked away in the back pocket of my mind for years. We'll come back to that in a minute. Now, all of this was happening in the late 1960s and early 1970s. I was reading these books about Zen and thinking about Zen as this intellectual puzzle. Meanwhile, in Berkeley, Mel Weitzman had just founded the Berkeley Zen Center in 1967, and Suzuki Roshi was still alive and teaching in San Francisco. So here were two just incredible opportunities for me to not only go to a nearby Zen center and sit with Mel Weitzman, but to actually go and sit at the feet of Suzuki Roshi in San Francisco. But I never did anything to connect with them. And looking back on it, I think there are sort of two reasons for that. One was that, as I said, Zen for me at that point was just an intellectual exercise. So just reading books and thinking about it and talking to my friends about it, and that should be enough. And then the other thing was, any of you who have read a lot of Zen stories, old Zen stories from Japan, know that particularly from the Rinzai side of the house, there's a fair amount of kind of startling stuff. And I had these images of, like, I heard about Tassajara, you know, oh, gee, I could go to Tassajara. Well, they'd make me sit outside in the freezing rain for several days of Tongariro, of course. And then they would take mercy on me and bring me inside and hit me with a stick. And there were all these stories that one read about students getting hit with sticks and their fingers cut off and cats cut in half. And Zen just sounded really kind of scary. So it was much more comfortable to just kind of treat it as an intellectual thing and just keep reading books. I mean, who wanted to do all that horrible stuff? So I really did miss meditation, though. And years later, in the 1990s, I actually did try yoga again. This time, I was with a group that had no complicated belief system, but also no meditation. It was just the hatha poses. So it was kind of a funny kind of exercise class. And I liked it. It was very nice, but there was definitely something missing. So that was in the 1990s. And then in the year 2000, my wife, Suzanne, who some of you know, Suzanne and I were planning our wedding. And our wedding took place in the hills above Santa Cruz. We needed somebody to marry us, to perform the ceremony. And we chose the interdenominational chaplain at Dominican Hospital, which is the big hospital in Santa Cruz. In fact, it's the hospital where my dad had been a patient near the end of his life. Resonates a little bit with some of what Vanessa has been doing with her intensive training as a hospital chaplain. And I remember when we interviewed the chaplain, who was wonderful, by the way, he asked me if I had any religious affiliation. And I said, well, no, but I kind of felt like Zen Buddhism had always seemed like kind of the leading candidate. So that was maybe a hint that I should have paid a little bit more attention to. Now, Suzanne remembered that. And a couple of years later, she pointed out to me that there was a continuing education class or an extension class at Stanford. So I could go in the evenings and I could study Zen as a college course. Oh boy, that's great. Reading books, listening to lectures, discussing in class. That sounded just like my attitude towards Zen. Very sort of academic. I mean, maybe there'd even be a midterm. That would be exciting. But the best part was the instructor. It was this fellow named Les Kay. And one of the things that Les did, even in addition to teaching a very sort of Stanford Extension-ish kind of course, was at the end of each class, he had a short period of Zazen. And that was really had an impact on me. I remember toward the end of that class, toward the last class, having a couple of hallway chats with Les after having sat Zazen for a while, both in class and I started sitting at home. And I said to Les, wow, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. And Les just smiled and quietly said, well, just always do it today and the rest of your life will take care of itself. I like that a lot. The other thing I said to him was, looking back over those 30 years, I said, I feel like I've had a great vehicle parked in my driveway all these years, and I just sat inside the house reading the owner's manual. And Les just smiled. Well, after the Stanford class ended, I started coming to Canando. That was about 20 years ago at the old Zendo. One wonderful little bit of irony about that is, given my whole sort of academic approach to Zen up to that point, the old Zendo in Mountain View was at the corner, at the intersection of University and College Avenues. Sounds very academic. So the first Wednesday evening that I came to Canando, I went into this sort of ante room of the place, some of you may remember that, waiting to enter the Zendo, sort of the way we do outside the Zendo now. And as I came into the room, I saw Les across the room, standing there in his robes. And I remember that I walked across the room and sort of tried to approach him as I would have approached him as my Stanford instructor, just for another nice little hallway chat. And he looked at me in a way that instantly conveyed the fact that he wasn't my Stanford instructor anymore. He was now my Zen teacher. It was almost like ESP. So people often say that Zen feels like coming home. Not long after I started coming to Canando, I recall looking at myself in the mirror and asking, so, am I a Zen Buddhist yet? And the answer seemed clear. Deep down, I've been a Zen Buddhist for a very long time. I just didn't know what it was called, even though I've been reading all those books. A few years ago, I had another encounter with that idea of logical incompleteness. I was on a trip and I stopped in for morning Zazen in a little Zendo outside Asheville, North Carolina. And as I was sitting there early in the morning in this strange, unfamiliar Zendo, out of the blue came an insight that the impossibility of understanding the self through rational, logical thought is caused by the mind's intimacy with itself, but that same intimacy is what makes our practice work. So that spiritual intimacy is both the problem and the solution. I've often thought since that flash of light that maybe this is what Master Jizo meant when he said to Hogen, "Not knowing is the most intimate." So I've been coming to Canondo now for about 20 years, a little more. After a year or so, I realized that there was something out of balance. I was getting more out of it than I was putting into it. And I really wanted to fix that balance, and I clearly didn't want to fix it by getting less out of it, so I better put more into it. And since then, I have served as secretary, a member of the board, vice president, president, and spent time working on the irrigation system, the HVAC system, and these days I'm sort of the informal under-assistant facilities manager helping out Diane. I mean, Canondo just means a tremendous amount to me. Canondo, it's definitely my spiritual home. And I'd like to say that it always will be, or perhaps, as Les told me 20 years ago, I should say, it was my spiritual home yesterday, it's my spiritual home today, and I'm just going to let tomorrow take care of itself. So that's basically all I had to say tonight about the long and winding road that brought me to Canondo 20 years ago and my love for the place that's keeping me there now. Thank you all. Diane?
Thank you, Dave. So I had a similar experience that you had when you talked about how close you were to maybe actually sitting with Suzuki Roshi and actually practicing Zen with some of those people, those early people, because about the same your era, I used to go to Japantown all the time. I loved everything Japanese, and I used to go and buy Zori and other Japanese things, and I had a longing for some connection there. And there I was, right around the corner from that Buddhist church that Suzuki Roshi came to. And, you know, it was, what, more than 30 years later that I finally came to Zen, and I tried meditation on my own, on and off, during those years and practice some yoga like you do. And I wonder if you or I had actually connected with some of those people then. I wonder how different our practice would be now. I wonder if we had to go through our journey, you know, the way we did to get to where we are and to be practicing where we are now. And so I just wonder what you think about that. I mean, you can't go back and change things, but maybe we all have to go on our journeys the way we did and find things through that, those paths that you described.
Well, thank you, Diane. I think you have a very important point there. I mean, I don't really look back at those 30 years and say, oh, my life was wasted during that period. I mean, there's a part of me that sort of feels a bit of that, you know. I mean, the idea that Suzuki Roshi was just across the Bay Bridge and I never went over and even saw him. I feel a little sad about that. But, you know, what you were just describing in a funny way is sort of similar to something that Suzanne and I talk about sometimes in terms of our relationship. I've known Suzanne since we were 15. And we've often talked about, and we went to school together. We were classmates in school. And we've often talked about what it would have been like if we had gotten together back then and how our lives would have been different. And there's a lot of positive feeling about that. But we've also, in our saner moments, said, you know, we probably weren't ready for each other. So, yes, it's a very interesting question. What would have happened if I, you know, started sitting at the Berkeley Zen Center? I can't imagine anything bad would have happened, but at the same time, maybe I just wasn't ready. Thank you, Diane.
Thank you, Dave, for a wonderful talk. So beautifully composed. And it made me think when you and Diane were talking about what if there had been a different scenario, that somehow the way your talk presented things, it sounds like be hard to be a better scenario. It seemed like I was curious about the relationship. At the beginning, you talked about being a mathematics student and this controversy at the time between consistency and completion. And it seems like you talked about your an insight that you received in kind of similar terms. You know what I mean? You said I can't remember exactly, but it had to do with there was kind of a parallel, anyhow, that you expressed.
Yes.
This the intimacy of spiritual experience was not logically accessible or explainable. Is that there was something due to the very intimacy of it that made it inaccessible to I was curious if you would say a little more about that, anyhow, if I'm making if I'm identifying in an understandable way what you said.
Yes, you very much hit on exactly the point that I was trying to make, that the nugget of those logical mathematical proofs always seems to be a self-referential paradox. And I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that the self-referential paradox of the mind trying to view itself is basically the same kind of thing, that we can't really reason logically about ourselves and come to any sort of real self-awareness that way. I mean, it's not that thinking about yourself is useless, but to really get a deep understanding is more about the subjective experience of your consciousness. And that's more illuminating than, you know, that's accessing, as you would call it in the mathematical sense, that's accessing a truth that can't be derived logically.
Uh-huh.
So yes, you've identified a parallel there that was quite intentional. I'm sorry if it wasn't more obvious.
Thank you. In the Genjo Koan talks that some of us have attended at Everyday Zen, there's the phrase in Genjo Koan, if one side is illuminated, the other side is dark. And that, as you explained that, it brought that up. Thank you so much. It was really a delightful, deep talk.
Thank you, Phil. May?
Thank you, Dave. I thoroughly enjoy your talk. Oftentimes, I always think you talk too much. But then I'm like, geez, that was myself. So thank you for being a mirror all the time. I thoroughly enjoy the math piece. This is my first time to listen that, you know, you tell us in such great detail. I am the fan of the math and fan of the physics, and I love Richard Feynman, you know, there's no why. And then, but all intellectual, you know, I feel like this intellectual thing is already there forever. And then, but until it takes forever to truly feel it, you know, every piece of the body truly feel it. That's such a long, long time. And then, when I first came here, I said, whoa, you guys is in Suzuki's time, you know, that's interesting, you know, 50 years is older than me. Okay, I can't, you know, so this time is really strange concept right now. And then I keep thinking, you know, this is such an illusion. You mentioned Mel Whitman or Suzuki or even less than 30 years ago, but you're all here. You're all here. And then I really appreciate your affirmation about being a nerd, okay, and then being trapped in the box, and then try so hard to get out, but there's no out, there's no in. It's just thank you, David. Thank you very much.
David?
Wonderful way-seeking mind talk, Dave. It's good to hear a person of similar age give a beginner's mind talk. It's kind of a long way back. I had the image of you sitting at a table with a jigsaw puzzle. And the jigsaw puzzle is called My Life, and it's not put together yet. It's on little bits here and there. And if you could describe the jigsaw puzzle is the intellectual fruit of all your reading and studying and pondering. And I wonder, could you say what has happened to those jigsaw puzzle pieces since you actually started sitting at Kanando?
Well, I think I'm more comfortable with the limitations on putting the whole jigsaw puzzle together intellectually. The last time I gave a talk, I talked a little bit about the idea of subjectivity versus objectivity. And of course, all of this intellectualizing is about objectivity and standing back from the thing that you're studying, which is precisely the thing that you cannot do with your own consciousness. You cannot really step back from it. And that's the value of the subjective foundation. And really, if you think about, we often are tempted to think of objective, scientific, rational, logical reality as being what's real, and that which is subjective as being sort of an illusion. But really, the only thing that we have, the only place or form in which we have any direct contact with that which is actually real is with our own consciousness, our own Buddha nature. And really, that which we call objective is in some senses mediated and derived. And they're both fine. They're both wonderful ways of experiencing the world, but neither one of them dominates the other. They really have to find a harmony. It's the harmony of difference and equality.
Thank you, Dave. Sounds like a deep learning.
Hi, Dave. Long time.
Yes.
Thank you for your talk. I just wanted to make you I think it's a kind of an original question. When you said that you started intellectually getting close to Zen, reading books at the end of the 60s, and then you went to the class at Stanford, and 20 years later, you still practice. What do you think that was the motivation or the need or something that was missing, trying to search to find it, that drove you to Zen and keep you in Zen?
Well, I think that there was always that spiritual hunger there, which I suspect that in various ways we all experience. And for me, that just amplified the disappointment that I felt when I got involved with things that seemed to be promising that kind of spiritual fulfillment, but ended up just being complicated dogma that one was supposed to take on faith without questioning. And the fact that Zen, in many ways, the exact opposite of that. I always think of that line in the Christian hymn that says, "Drive the dark of doubt away." And in Zen, we say, "Small doubt, small enlightenment; great doubt, great enlightenment." Mm-hmm. So I can't say that I'm an expert on the world's religions, but in my own experience, Zen really is unique in the sense that it's not that there aren't any ideas, there isn't any philosophy around Zen, but it's all sort of a byproduct, and it's not really central. What's really important is the experience and the insights that you derive directly from the experience. Let me tell you another example of that in terms of, one of my characteristics, I don't want to put a value judgment on it, let's just say the characteristic of mine is that, as I say, I love to read books, and in particular, I, for so many years, have been reading books on Zen. My Zen bookshelf at home is bigger than the Cannondale Library. Hmm. And it's just this sort of mad grasping. I remember one time being in a store and picking up a book called, Introduction to Zen Buddhism, and the first page of it said, "You can't learn Zen by reading a book." So I bought the book. And somebody came over to my house one time and looked at this bookcase and said, "Wow, Dave, that's really impressive that you have all those books on Zen." And, at that point, I'd gotten well past the point of being impressed with myself for having a lot of Zen books. And what I said was, some of you may have heard me say this before, I said to my friend, Zen books are sort of like bags of manure. If you just go out and buy a bunch of them and put them on shelves in your living room and expect everybody to be impressed, you really haven't done anything except make your house smell bad. I don't know how many of you have heard the phrase, "That stinks of Zen." But that whole approach to Zen books or bags of manure isn't really very fruitful. But if you take those bags of manure and you just take them out and spade them into your garden, then maybe later something wonderful will happen. And I'm not saying that Zen books are without value, but again, they're not central. And if they can be a little bit of a help in smoothing or expediting your practice, well, that's as much as you can expect. It's the practice itself that is really the heart of the matter. I don't know if I'm really addressing your question or not. I've sort of meandered around here.
That's okay. Yep. Thank you, Liz. Thank you, David. Nice to see you.
Umar.
Hey, Dave, how are you?
Hanging in there.
Good, good, good. So just want to say, I recently heard an interview with Shohaku Okamura, and mm-hmm. he said when he had to come to that place where he had to decide if he wanted to be a scholar or if he wanted to be a practitioner, he had studied a lot of Zen literature, and he came to this understanding that reading Zen literature, too much of it, it was like you're comparing, and becoming a Zen scholar was like you were comparing recipes, saying, oh, this is one recipe and here's another recipe which works better. So he said, when I came to that point, I decided, no, I think I'm better at becoming a Zen practitioner. So he became a Zen practitioner. I just wanted to share that. I found it really interesting. Your talk reminded me of that.
Yeah. That's going all right.
Yeah. Thank you.
Philip, you have another question.
Please. I was curious, Dave, you said toward the end of your talk that there was a point where you were enjoying practice and getting a lot out of it, but felt like you wanted to give back to some extent. Not sure how you phrased that. It was inspiring to hear you talk with enthusiasm about starting to take on roles at the Zendo, and I wondered, did you notice any change in your in the practice that you were getting a lot out of before you became more involved in giving back? Or how it affected your Zazen practice, for instance, if it did?
I'm not sure that I would say so much that I got more out of Zazen, but that I felt better about it. It felt more balanced somehow to be putting effort back into the place that I was getting to practice, and the Sangha that I was practicing with, and the teacher I was studying with. When I was a newcomer at Canon Do, it was really wonderful, and everyone was very welcoming and everything, but it was only when I really started trying to actually participate more and give back to the Sangha that I really felt that sort of completion of my involvement. And I think that really helped me relate my Zen practice to my everyday life.
Thank you.
May?
Sorry, I was inspired by the cookbooks and then your Zen books. So sounds like you have a lot of recipes. So if you're a cook, and you cook yourself, so what kind of dishes today are you? Or what kind of dishes half century ago, you know, what kind of dishes were you back then? Or what kind of dishes are you right now?
Are you asking for an analogy? Or are you asking literally, what do I cook?
Analogy. Well, yeah, just what kind of dishes are you right now? Compare you to a dishes.
Wow. What kind of dish am I?
But you're a cook yourself, right? Basically. Zazen is cook yourself.
Yes. Well, I would say whatever kind of dish I am now, I'm sort of medium rare. I'm still cooking. I don't know much more I can say about that.
Thank you. Just continue cook.
Oh, Teresa.
Hi Dave, I don't really have a question, but I also wanted to say thank you for your talk. And we just, Philip said, I really appreciate your presence at Kananda. I think there are some people at Kananda that meant a lot for people who come for the first time, like me, of course, Les, but you and Diane and some people that are always there, I think give a lot of stability and continuity to the place. And thank you also for that story that you share about Ashlang. I've never heard you share that story before. Was it Ashlang?
No, actually it was Asheville, North Carolina. I've been to the Ashland Zen Center and it's quite wonderful, but no, this one was actually in Asheville, North Carolina.
Good.
Which is another town that's amazingly for North Carolina, it's amazingly like Berkeley.
Well, thank you for sharing that story.
Oh, Diane?
I loved May's question about your recipes and what you're cooking now, and you said you're sort of medium rare. My dad was a great barbecuer, and when he would be doing steak on the barbecue, he could just put his thumb on the meat and tell when it was done, like medium rare. He could just kind of push on the meat. And so when my dad was dying at the age of 93, and my brother-in-law was there with him, we were all there. And Bill went up to my dad and put his thumb on him and said, John, no, you're not done yet, John. You're just not quite done yet. And so it made me think about that, how, you know, there he was dying, but he just wasn't done yet. And I sort of think like, we're never really done. We're not done yet. We're still alive. We're still growing. We're still learning. We're still practicing. And here we are together. Thank you.
You know, your whole story about whether you're done yet reminds me of there's a wonderful story about Suzuki Roshi talking to a senior student, and he's telling the student, well, it's kind of my responsibility to be difficult with you. You know, you senior students. I mean, you know, junior students, I wouldn't be so difficult, but you're a senior student. And he said, and it's difficult for me to be difficult with you. And the image that I got in my mind about that, I don't know how many of you have ever made hand cranked ice cream, but if you're actually serious about making your own ice cream, you don't do one of these things with an electric motor. You crank it by hand. And the reason is that at the beginning, when it's all liquid, you want to crank it not too fast, because if you crank it too fast, you'll churn it into butter. But as it starts to solidify, what's happening is that it's freezing on the edge of the container. And as you turn the crank handle, it's scraping it off the edge. And you want to do that faster and faster, because you don't want big ice crystals in your ice cream. You want to be very smooth. So paradoxically, as it gets harder and harder to crank, you have to crank faster and faster. And basically, it gets harder and harder, and you crank faster and faster until you can't crank anymore, and then it's done. It always struck me that was kind of analogous to the need for a Zen teacher to be more and more strict with his student until the student is done.
Yeah.
Dave, can we make a request, and the next time bring us some ice creams? Okay.
I'll load up the ice cream maker, but you're going to have to turn the crank.
Okay. I'll do that. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
This talk was brought to you by the Kanando Zen Meditation Center in Mountain View, California. For more information or to support this podcast, go to kanando.org. That's kanando.org.